True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. And if you'd like to skip the intro or move to any specific part of the podcast, please refer to the timestamps listed in the episode description. Thank you. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast with Stephanie and Olivia. It is June 20th, 2026. I know last episode I said July. It's June. I'm sorry if anyone was confused thinking that we were in the future and that you were in the past. I was just wrong. Shocking.
Just a few episodes, maybe.
Yeah. I know it's very shocking that I make mistakes. Just kidding, because I always make mistakes. But yes, it is June, the very end of June, which is crazy. Like, where has the year gone? My weather update. And for those who don't care, because I just want to remind everyone, there's a timestamp. You could skip the chat. So weather update. We have like a heat wave coming here. It's been very hot, but it's going to be like over 100 degrees here with high humidity. So I'm really not looking forward to that. In the winter, I remember thinking summer would be better because it's hard having a baby when it's very, very cold. But it's also hard having a baby when it's very, very hot and warm. Mm. So it's also just hard having a baby all the time.
I've got one of each. I've got one December baby, so she's our summer one, and the other one's July. So one winter, one summer.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got August, the end of summer. But yeah, it's going to be very hot here this week. So I like when it's warm, but when it's like getting to 100 and humid, that's a lot for New York. I did want to discuss one other thing besides, well, do you want to talk about your weather briefly?
And then I'll go to my other topic. It has gotten like colder. The days are still lovely. Like, I'm just looking at because I can never remember the Fahrenheit to, so I'm just going to Fahrenheit. So it's still like, see, on Thursday it's going to be 72. So like, it still is nice in the day.
It's freaking summer.
But it's like, does get cold at night. But I found it funny because I was reading the other week. I don't know if you guys have seen all the articles too about how they think El Nino is coming back, which is drought conditions, hot, dry. But then fires. But since I saw all those articles last week, they're like, this is going to be, and I know it probably hasn't happened yet, it's coming, but it's basically rained a lot. So I was just looking at the articles this morning. It says heavy rain to soak Australia's east as un-El Nino-like weather continues. So they've said it's coming. Maybe it will come. It's nice. It's just pleasant. Like, it's fine. Nothing major. Could be worse. Where I live could be better.
Yeah, it's just funny because I'm like, 72 is like the perfect day.
I think like that's a hot day. Like, most days when I looked up the Fahrenheit, then it's like between 60 and 66 is a max. That's still not bad. Yeah, but
it's like a little chilly, but
yeah, a little fresh.
Fresh, yeah. Okay, my other thing that I have to discuss is a lot of you who follow me on Instagram are my enemies right now because I was reading this little book that Jack has, and it was all words that rhyme, and there's dog and frog. And I'm like, that doesn't rhyme. And so I posted it as a poll just thinking it was funny and that everyone would agree with me and be like, no, that doesn't rhyme. And everyone's like, no, it rhymes. And I'm like, what?
I also think it rhymes, I have to say. Same amount of syllables. If my frog had an additional syllable, I'd be like, maybe not. But I feel like dog and frog, I would absolutely say are rhyming words.
But then some people messaged me and said it's regional because I guess in New York we say dog more like dog.
Even when you were pronouncing it then, I was like, oh, it does sound a little bit different. Like the two.
Yeah, and then when you said it, I was like, no, it does sound the same. But then I'm like trying to say it, dog, so it rhymes with frog. Like, I can't do it. Like, frog, dog, that, dog. I don't know. I can't say it. It's funny because I don't really think of myself as like having an accent, but obviously everyone has an accent compared to people from different places.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny because the people who also like agreed with me that doesn't rhyme, it's mostly people from like around here that I know.
I guess, yeah, because it's almost like an og kind of resistance.
Yeah.
Og.
Yeah, but anyways, I was very disappointed in all of my Instagram followers for making me feel stupid once again.
Write a note to the book editor.
Yeah,
it's freaking... less controversial rhyming word next time.
And it's the first one too. It's on the cover. I'm like, are you kidding me? And the rest are like pale whale, bat, cat. I'm like, yeah, those are all easy ones. You're gonna start off
really confident
with the heavy
in
hitter.
Dog frog rhyming.
Yeah. So fine, I guess it rhymes. But if you ask me, I'm saying it does not rhyme. And that's all I have to say today. Anyways, one of you is not my enemy. So I did find a listener of the week this week from Patreon. Her name is Sabrina, and she actually was the first one to point out that I said July instead of June, but in a friendly, nice way, which everyone did. I nobody was rude about it, shockingly.
No, but I thought we'd get at least one rude one when you mentioned it. I was like, yeah, sure.
I was like, wow, they don't even know the month.
You're so dumb. What are you even doing? Why are you even podcasting?
The American one doesn't even know the date. So Sabrina from Patreon said, TBH, it's just like a fun quirk of the podcast. Your tired mom brain gets a pass. I like that you guys show that you're regular people. I've listened for years and I recommend this podcast to everyone I talk to about true crime. I call you guys my podcast because you're the only ones I listen to regularly and you're just a part of my life now. Love you guys.
Oh, aww. So nice.
Glad to be part of your life, Sabrina. You're not my enemy.
You can stay around. And for new Patreons this week, we've got Jillian, Alyssa, Brody, Maddie, I think it is, and Bobby. So thank you very, very much.
Woo! Thanks for joining.
Yes.
Besties. I always have to say besties. Okay. Before we get into the rest of the episode, we have a quick word from our sponsor, Quince. Summer always makes me rethink what I'm reaching for every day. Lighter fabrics, better materials, pieces that just feel good the moment that you put them on and look effortless. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. I really wanted some things that were high quality, breathable linen, soft organic cotton, washable silk, but without the huge luxury markup. And it's that rare balance where everything feels elevated, but it's still easy. So being postpartum, I've needed to get some new basic things since my body has changed. And I ordered a couple things from Quince for summer because it's been so hot here. Like, I need new summer clothes desperately. So I got a pair of the 100% European linen high-waisted shorts and a pair of the classic running shorts in royal blue. And I'm so excited for them to come because I need some high-quality clothes to survive this summer.
Quince has beautiful everyday pieces like 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops with styles starting at $32. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And it's not just clothing. Quince has really become a destination for elevated essentials across home, kitchen, bedding, and beyond, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/TCS for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/TCS for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/TCS.
Today we are talking about, kind of something different for us whenever we do like an older one, because I feel like we do much more current ones. But this case was suggested to us by Sarah, and we're going to be talking about serial killer Tommy Lynn Sells. And I'd like heard his name before, but I didn't really know much about him because I don't know. It sounds weird to be like serial killers aren't that interesting to me. Like they are and they aren't, because I feel like they're just not that interesting sometimes. I don't know.
One I'd love to cover one day, and it's on my list, but I just feel like it will be massive, is Israel Keyes. I find him fascinating.
Yeah, we get that request a lot.
Yeah, all the time. And I will do it. It's just one of those things when I start, and I think I don't even know how I would ever finish this ever. It would just go forever. But whereas this one, I'm the same. I kind of knew his name and like a general overview of his crimes. But when I delved into it, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is insane. And I've said it before, I just don't know if it could ever happen today again. Maybe. I guess it's just so much harder for people to carry out crimes with all this CCTV tracking, all that type of stuff, whereas this happened in a time prior to that, and he was just one of the most depraved people I've ever read about.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm like backtracking what I said. People are gonna think it's like crazy that I'm like, I'm not that into serial killers. It's not that I'm not interested in serial killers, I just feel like I've read about all of them and I'm just more interested in different types of true crime. I don't know why I'm feeling like I have to defend myself. I'm just thinking ahead.
I am really interested in missing people all the time. I've said that, you know, everyone, I feel like everyone likes to read about different, when I say likes, it's obviously not entertainment, but people are interested
it's more fascinated in
facets
by.
Of crime. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's get into it. Enough of me just talking about myself. So Tabby Lynn Sells was a drifter whose crime stretched across multiple U.S. states. Known as the Coast to Coast Killer, he claimed responsibility for dozens of murders, though he was only convicted in two cases. His transient lifestyle, violent childhood, and habit of targeting vulnerable victims made him one of the most elusive and disturbing killers of his era. This is a quote from him, just so you get a vibe. It says, "I am hatred. When you look at me, you look at hate. I don't know what love is. Two words I don't like to use are love and sorry, because I'm about hate." Maybe I just think like they're losers. Maybe that's why I don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, cool, bro.
The first time I did a shot of dope, it was the best feeling I ever had in my life. And the first time I killed somebody, it was such a rush. And it was just like that shot of dope. Every time I did it, it was that rush again. And I started chasing that high.
Tommy Lynn Sells was once a little boy growing up in St. Louis. But around the age of 14, he says he became addicted to killing.
How many people have you killed?
Lord, I don't know. I don't know.
10?
Yeah.
20?
Probably.
30?
It's up there.
50?
But see, I'm not Billy the Kid making notches on my holster. So I know it's been a lot.
Tommy Lynn Sells and his twin sister Tammy Jean were born in Oakland, California on June 28, 1964. They were two of five children born to Nina, who was an unwed mother. Jerry, Kelvin, and Charles. An insurance agent named William Sells was said to be the father of the children, but there have been claims about the genuine parentage. Tommy and Tammy's biological father is thought to be a man named Joe Lovins, who died when Tommy was 11. True crime author Diane Fanning, who wrote about Tommy in Through the Window, alleges that Joe bailed William Sells out of financial difficulty, and William then agreed to claim the children as his own as part of an insurance scam. William's job also meant that the children were provided health insurance. So basically, he took in the, quote, bastard children.
Yeah. It's just one of those scenarios where they had an awful
it's
childhood.
Like,
but
yeah.
Like that, imagine this being, I don't know, giving your children
away.
Through an insurance scam. It's crazy.
Yeah. When the twins were 18 months old, they contracted meningitis. Tammy passed away from the illness. Shortly after this, Tommy was sent to live with his Aunt Bonnie in Missouri. His mother sent for him when he was 5 years old after discovering that Bonnie wanted to adopt him, which is weird. It's like, you gave him
she's
away.
She's happy for
but
him
now that-
to live with the aunt until the aunt actually wants to give him maybe a stable type of life. And then she's like, no way, you're coming
and
back.
She's like, no.
Yeah.
Tommy's life of neglect and delinquency began very early. At the crazy age of 7, he began drinking alcohol. The alcohol was given to him by his maternal grandmother. And according to ClarkProsecutor.org, he began smoking ditchweed, marijuana, and narcotics at the age of 10. So that's crazy.
Yeah.
He would later tell ABC News, "The first time I did a shot of dope, it was the best feeling I ever had in my life. The first time I killed somebody, it was such a rush. It was just like that, a shot of dope every time I did it. It was that rush again, and I started chasing that high." Within a year after that, he began socializing with a man named Willis Clark. Tommy alleged that Willis molested him. Tommy would claim that Nina encouraged this relationship, which caused him a lot of trauma. When Tommy was 13, he entered his grandmother's bed while she was sleeping, and he was nude at the time. This incident led to him being banned from her home. Shortly after this, Nina and his siblings left town, and Tommy was left to fend for himself. At this time, Tommy obtained access to a gun, and he shot a woman and assaulted her, but she survived the attack.
I tried to find some more information on that because it seems like there should be more of a record. Did anything happen to him? It's just kind of mentioned in a lot of passing in articles and documentation about him, but he was essentially still so young, like 13 years old, and he's apparently doing this to a woman, and it's just kind of casually thrown in there and mentioned. I don't know what the outcome of that was.
Yeah, it's crazy it's so young, but I feel like he was never treated with empathy. So like, how is he supposed to learn about being empathetic towards other people?
I feel like sometimes, obviously not to start a different debate, but I feel like he was absolutely a product of his upbringing. You know, he had a horrible, shitty upbringing with shitty things that happened to him and no parenting, essentially. So I feel like that would have contributed greatly to what he ended up doing.
Yeah. By the age of 14, Tommy was living as a nomad. In 1981, when he was 16, Tommy visited his family who were living in Little Rock, Arkansas. His mother evicted him from the home after he tried to molest her in the shower. His mental health continued to deteriorate, and his first arrest came in 1982 when he was arrested for public intoxication. He made his way across the United States, hitchhiking and train hopping, and he would hold multiple short-term jobs between 1978 and 1999, including manual labor roles and barber jobs. He was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he was in prison several times. In 1990, he stole a truck in Wyoming and was put away for 16 months. I think that's a long time for stealing a truck. I feel like you hear child abuse cases nowadays and they're like, get like a couple months.
Yeah.
According to the Murder Interrupted article from crimelibrary.com, Tommy was diagnosed with personality disorders, addiction, and psychosis. In May 1992, Tommy was panhandling under an overpass in Charleston, West Virginia. He had a sign that said, "I will work for food." A woman named Fabian Witherspoon, who was 19 years old, took pity on him. She took Tommy to her home and asked him to wait outside while she went in to get him some food. By the time she got back to the front door, he had unsurprisingly entered the home. He took a knife from her kitchen, trapped her in the bathroom, and attempted to rape her. Fabian got a hold of a ceramic duck and she hit Tommy in the head multiple times. She managed to get the knife off of him and stabbed him, nicking his kidney and liver and his testicle. Tommy then started to beat her over the head with a piano stool. He tried to escape the home, but he ended up in police custody and in the ICU. Fabian also obtained serious injuries, including a head wound and a hand injury that required surgery. She said, "I just wanted to get away and I didn't realize I'd stabbed him. It was very, very, very hard to know that I had the capability of hurting someone like that. I always felt if something like that ever happened to me, I would faint and die. I would not fight. But I found out I was somebody different." Tommy was charged with malicious wounding, and he took a plea deal, which meant that he was to serve 5 years in prison. While he was in prison, he married a woman named Nora Price. Like, getting married on the side all in prison. Like, I'd have this question about a lot of people who marry murderers. I just do not understand.
For some reason, I don't even know why, but on my Facebook, it always pops up. Like, you can write to these guys who are getting out of prison soon. And like, when I read the comments, like, he's in for murder, he's in for child sexual assault. I'm like, what's going on? Who is searching out these people to communicate and maybe start a relationship with?
Yeah, I don't know. It's insane. It's like way past the I can fix him thing.
Yeah.
He moved to Tennessee to be with Nora. Their marriage didn't last long once he was out of custody. Shocking. He left her that same year and started going cross-country again. Nora did give birth to Tommy's son around that time, and she gave the child up for adoption. In the late 1990s, Tommy allegedly married a woman named Jessica Levery in Del Rio, Texas. Some reports say Jessica had 4 children and that Tommy moved into a trailer with her and her kids. The marriage was not legal because Tommy was still married to his first wife. Tommy and Jessica began attending the Grace Community Church in Texas, and he became friends with a couple named Terry and Crystal Harris, and they had children, daughters named Kayleen, or Katie, who was 13, and Lori, who was 12, and a son named Justin, who was 14. Justin was also blind. Tommy began going to the Harris's double-wide. He went under the premise of asking Terry for help about his marriage troubles. It's believed that he was really going to the property to creep on the young daughters and their mother. Yeah, I don't think he really cares about his marriage.
Yeah.
On December 30th, 1999, Tommy ran into Terry at a gas station, and Terry told him that he was going on a trip to Kansas to help collect belongings for some friends, Pam Searles and her boyfriend Doug Lurker. They were moving to the area, and this would later prove to be a fatal comment. Tommy spent the evening at Larry's Lakeside Tavern. Bartender would later speak about how he harassed her all night. She said, "He was obsessed with having sex with me. That's all we would talk about all night long." Around 2 a.m., Tommy was basically chased out of the bar by another patron who overheard the conversation. Since Tommy knew that the Harris females would be home alone, he headed to their address. He arrived there around 4 a.m. and also at the home were the Searles children, who were the people moving to the area.
Yeah, so the father of the Harris family had gone with the Searles, like the mother and her boyfriend, to collect their stuff. So the kids were staying with the wife in this double-wide trailer. So there was a bunch of kids and one mother at the property.
Tommy entered the home through an open window. He first went to Justin's bedroom, but since Justin was blind, he could actually sense that someone was in the room and thought it was one of his siblings. And he called out, will y'all stop coming into my room? So Tommy moved on to the next bedroom. He flicked his cigarette lighter to light the area, and he found one of the Searles children, who was 7 years old, asleep. He moved on to the primary bedroom and found Crystal Harris asleep with Lori. He then went into a bedroom where Katie was sleeping in a bottom bunk, and Crystal Searles, who was 10, was asleep on the top bunk. Tommy put his hand over Katie's mouth and pulled out a 12-inch boning knife. He sliced off her shorts and underwear and began touching her, but she managed to wriggle free and started screaming. Tommy turned on the light and moved to the door to block her escape. Katie had been cut by the knife and she yelled, "You cut me." I'm shocked that like nobody else, like a double wide's not that big.
Yeah, I agree. Like, and they would have, yeah, would have thought close proximity. It does sound like there was some screaming and struggling, but maybe not.
Yeah. Crystal would later say he had his hand over her mouth. She was struggling. She told me with her eyes to stay there and not move. So I didn't. Tommy went to her, covered her mouth and cut her throat twice. She fell to the floor and Tommy stabbed her 16 more times. Crystal said she just fell and then she started making really bad noises like she was gagging for air but couldn't get any because of the blood. How traumatic for such a little kid to witness. He then started to move towards Crystal and she said, "I'll be quiet, I promise, I won't say anything," and he cut her throat as well. She fell to the ground but pretended to be dead. Crystal said, "He reached over and cut my throat. I just laid there and pretended I was dead. If he knew I was alive, he would come back and kill me for sure." Tommy then left the home. Crystal assumed that everyone in the house must have been dead, you know, since no one heard them and came to help.
I just can't imagine that poor little girl, 10 years old, thinking everyone else is dead, leaving the house with these horrific injuries, trying to get help. Just so horrible.
Yeah. So she ran over to a neighbor's for help and she had a severed trachea. Herb Betts was the neighbor, and he heard a knock on the door and peered through the peephole, and there stood Crystal in a t-shirt, boxer shorts, and socks, and she was covered in blood. The child was unable to speak because the knife had severed her windpipe and grazed the sheathing of her carotid artery. She had come within a millimeter of death. Bertz told Texas journalist John McCormick, "Her little eyes were saying to me, 'Help me.'" He dialed 911 as she laid waiting for help. Crystal asked for writing instruments, and she penned three brief notes saying, "The Harrises are hurt. Tell them to hurry. And will I live?" Herb said, "I kissed her on the forehead and told her several times that she was going to be all right. I didn't believe it. I thought she'd die on my kitchen floor." And there's a very sad picture of her in the hospital.
Yeah, so young.
Just shows her little baby face.
Yeah.
Crystal was able to provide a description of her attacker, and a sketch was created. Doug Lurker recalled that he had seen Tommy at a gas station before they left for Kansas and thought that the sketch resembled him. Doug told Texas Ranger John Allen about this, and he tracked a photo of Tommy down. Authorities went to Crystal's hospital room and showed her pictures of six men, one of which was Tommy, and she identified him as the attacker.
So I've seen a photo of the sketch. I don't know if I would personally say it looks a lot like Tommy did. Maybe he did look more similar back then. But the photos I've seen of him even back then, I feel like it's lucky that they managed to identify him at this time, because I don't think the sketch is a spot-on resemblance.
I think it's just because of the long hair and beard, maybe.
It looks like Jesus almost. It just looks like a guy with long hair and a beard, and it could be anyone. But I guess maybe at that point, maybe he fit that description. So I feel like it was quite lucky that they identified him so quickly.
Yeah, like I've only seen really one picture of him that looks kind of like that. Tommy was arrested on January 2nd at the trailer that he lived in with Jessica and her four children. While he was being taken to the sheriff's office, he said, "Well, I guess we've got a lot to talk about." Tommy told police that he killed people when they angered him. He said, "I lose it. I lose control of my thoughts. I lose control of my emotions. When you're not in control, bad things happen." Tommy also said that he had never left a witness alive before Crystal. When asked why he'd been caught, he said, "'Cause I left someone alive." Terry Harris, who's Katie's father, told the Kansas City Star, "'It just took 10 minutes for Sells to uproot our family. "'He stole our daughter's accomplishments every birthday, every holiday. "'It eats me up that I tried to help Tommy. "'I talked with him. "'He was a guy down on his luck, and I tried to help, "'and he repaid me by killing my daughter.'" Before we get into the rest of the story, this episode is brought to you by IQ Bar, our exclusive snack, hydration, and coffee sponsor. IQ Bar Protein Bars, IQ Mix Hydration Mixes, and IQ Joe Mushroom Coffees are the delicious low-sugar brain and body fuel you need to win your day. The Ultimate Sampler Pack is a great way to try all IQ Bar products and flavors. You get 9 IQ Bars, 8 IQ Mix Sticks, and 4 IQ Joe Sticks. All IQ Bar products are clean label certified and entirely free from gluten, dairy, soy, GMOs, and artificial ingredients.
I really love IQ Bar's plant protein bars. They're the smartest snack choice with plenty of plant protein, tons of fiber, and no added sugar. This morning, I actually had a peanut butter chip IQ bar for breakfast. So delicious. Tastes like a little treat in the morning, but it's so good for you. Absolutely love them. With over 20,000 five-star reviews and counting, more people than ever are fueling their busy lifestyles with IQ bars, brain and body boosting bars, hydration mixes, and mushroom coffees. The ultimate sampler pack includes all three. And right now, IQ bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% off all IQ bar products, including the ultimate sampler pack plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text CRIME to 64000. Text CRIME to 64000. That's CRIME to 64000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. So Tommy was charged with first-degree murder, which warranted a possible death penalty being imposed, and he went to trial in September of 2000. Tommy apparently knew that the odds of a not guilty verdict were not in his favor. He had a kind of a crude prison tattoo on his wrist, and he was asked about it. The tattoo was the number 13 and a half, and he said it meant 12 jurors, one judge, and a half-assed chance.
So, I feel like he thought that was probably so deep too.
And, and so like dumb. Edgy. Just
yeah, like whoa. Anyway.
So Tommy was convicted and sentenced to death on September 20th of 2000. There is information about his trial, but just kind of for the format of this episode, we're going to keep that short, but because I feel like more importantly is about the crimes that he has apparently confessed to or has been linked to, because there are so many. So we're going to go through them. We'll list them chronologically. His crimes do go back all the way to 1979. Some of the crimes that are listed online do not have specific dates attached to them, but I've kind of tried to figure out where they slot in, and we've noted the dates when they are confirmed. Ranger Allen was asked about why Tommy confessed, and he said he wants to clean the slate and get everything behind him. He's told us he wants closure for himself and for the families of the victims he's killed. Closure was his word. So we start in July of 1979 in Port Gibson in Mississippi. A man named John Cade, who was 39, was shot and killed during a home invasion. A man who resembled Tommy was seen near the scene, and it's believed he was confirmed to have been in that area around that time. In April 1982 in St. Louis, Missouri, a woman named Joanne Tate was murdered in her home. Her daughter, Melissa, 7 years old, was a witness and was also assaulted. They did identify a man as the possible perpetrator at the time. That man was named Rodney Lincoln, and he was identified as the killer. In 2015, Melissa contacted police, so she was the daughter, after watching an episode of Crime Watch Daily, which had a feature on Tommy. She said that she believes he was actually the person that killed her mother. And in 2018, Governor Eric Greitens commuted Rodney's sentence to time served, and he was released from prison. Again in St. Louis, this time in July 1983, so around a year after that, Colleen Gill was 33 and her daughter Tiffany, who was 4, were beaten to death with a blunt weapon in their home. A man who matched Tommy's description was seen leaving the scene, and Tommy had relatives that lived in the area that this murder happened in. So like, when we say things like that, there's kind of reason to believe he might be responsible for these killings because he could have been in the area at the time. Mm-hmm. In July of 1985, Tommy was working at a carnival in Springfield, Missouri. He met Ina Cord, who was 28, and her son Rory, who was 4 years old, while he was working there. She invited Tommy back to her home on July 26th of 1985. Tommy said they had sex and he fell asleep. When he woke up, he said Ina was stealing from his backpack. He then beat her to death with a baseball bat and murdered Rory as a witness. The bodies of the mother and son were found 3 days later, and Tommy had left town by that time. He also said that in 1986, he was working in St. Louis as a tow truck driver. He received a call from a sex worker whose car had broken down. When he arrived to help her, he suggested that she pay him in sex in lieu of money for the towing. She declined, and Tommy said that he shot her and threw her body in a river. In May of 1987, Suzanne Corks, who was 27, disappeared after leaving a nightclub in Lockport, New York. She remained missing for years until her body was found in September 1995 in an embankment near Niagara Falls. Her cause of death was not able to be established due to the state of her remains. In 2004, Tommy confessed that he had murdered a woman in that area at that time, and it was confirmed that he was in the vicinity in May 1987. Tommy was able to identify Suzanne but was not prosecuted by that point as he had already been sentenced to death. In October of 1987 in Lovelock, Nevada, Stephanie Stroh, who was 21, vanished from a truck stop. Tommy confessed to her murder. He said that she was hitchhiking and he offered her a ride to Reno. He said they took LSD together. He strangled her, covered her body in concrete and dumped her in a hot spring. Her remains have never been found. This one is so horrible. I just, like, they're all horrible, don't get me wrong, like heinous ways, but this one is just, oh, it makes me feel sick.
Yeah, this one is where I started being like, eh. Ooh,
yeah. So Tommy also confessed to the murders of four members of the Dardeen family in Ina, Illinois in November of 1987. Keith Dardeen was 29. He was shot in the head 3 times. His wife, Elaine, was 30 and she was pregnant at the time of the attack. She was so badly beaten that she went into labor and gave birth, and Tommy then beat her and the newborn to death. He also beat Peter Dardeen, who was 3, to death. The state's attorney declined to prosecute Tommy in this case because some of the statements he gave about the circumstances of the case were inaccurate. He apparently changed his story 3 times about how he'd met the family. Investigators eventually wanted to bring Tommy to Illinois to question him, but the request was refused by Texas officials as death row prisoners are not allowed to leave the state. I just don't have, why didn't they go to him? Why, like, maybe they tried, but, and I guess what's the point in prosecuting him when he's already been sentenced to death? But for that family of those horrific crimes, surely you'd want something to happen. I don't know. But apparently that's why nothing much ever happened with that one.
Yeah, it's that one is just like, how do you beat a newborn baby to death and a 3-year-old to death?
And to beat someone so horrifically that they're going to labor, she gave birth. Like, that's not a slow process. It's just horrible.
Yeah.
That is a slow process, I should say, not a fast process in giving birth. So Tommy claimed that in 1988, he met a woman and her son in Salt Lake City, Utah. He said they went on a camping trip together. Tommy confessed to murdering them and dumping their bodies in a river in Idaho. He also once confessed to killing a man in Chicago and disposing of his body in a dumpster. He named specific streets where this allegedly occurred, but no evidence was ever recovered. So I wonder if all of his confessions were true. He just seemed to have some supporting information about a lot of them, but maybe some of them were just kind of big noting. I guess it could have just been luck, because obviously he confessed to these a long time after they happened. So if a body's dumped in a dumpster, you've probably got very little chance of finding it years and years later.
Yeah.
In December of 1988, Tommy killed Kent Lawton, who was 51 in Tucson in Arizona. He said he killed Kent because Kent refused to pay for drugs. Tommy also claimed that he killed a woman in Truckee, California in January 1989 after a drug deal went wrong. He also claimed to have killed 2 female hitchhikers in Roseburg, Oregon in May of 1989. He also said that he had additional victims and he dumped their bodies in swamps in Florida and at various rest stops along the interstate in Pennsylvania. Tommy told authorities that in September 1991, he killed a woman named Margaret McLean and her daughter Pamela in Charleston, West Virginia. He said that in December 1991, in Mariana in Florida, there was a woman named Teresa Hall, who was 25, and her daughter Tiffany, who was 5. They were beaten to death in their home. The weapon used was a wooden table leg. The original suspect in this case was serial killer Angel Matarino Resendiz. He's suspected of carrying out 23 murders across the US and Mexico during the 1990s. So they thought he was the original suspect, but Tommy did eventually confess to being the actual killer in that case. In 2004, Tommy confessed that back in October of 1997, he broke into a home in Lawrenceville, Illinois, and he took a knife from the kitchen. He said that he stabbed a child named Joel Kirkpatrick, who was 10, to death as he slept in his bed. Joel's mother, Julie Ray, heard the screams and rushed to his room. She fought with Tommy and he managed to flee on foot from the property. So before Tommy confessed, which this is a wild case as well, Julie would end up being indicted for the murder of her son in the year 2000. Prosecutors alleged that her motive for killing her son was due to a custody battle. She did have Joel's blood on her clothing, and they used that as kind of evidence against her, which I don't really think is too surprising given the fact that she, you know, surprised the actual murderer and fought with him. So I don't think it's surprising that she ended up having her son's blood on her.
Yeah.
But Julie was found guilty of the murder in March 2002, and she was sentenced to 65 years in prison. After Tommy confessed to this crime in 2004, her conviction was reversed and the case was remanded for retrial. Julie was granted a certificate of innocence in November 2010 and was awarded $87,000 from the Illinois Court of Claims, which is insane to me.
Yeah.
Crazy. In October of 1997, Stephanie Mahaney, who was 13, was found dead in a pond west of Springfield, Missouri. Tommy said that he abducted her from her bed, drove her to a field, a 13-year-old, and injected her with cocaine before raping and strangling her. Yvette Mueller, who was 19, vanished from an RV park in Vegas in December of 1997. Tommy claims that he raped and killed a woman who matched her description. He said that he chopped up her body with an axe and buried her next to a river, and the body was never found as there was a landslide in the area. In April of 1998, carnival worker Thomas Brose, who was 40 years old, was shot to death in his motorhome in San Antonio, Texas. Tommy did confess to this one, but he later recanted, which is kind of weird. Why? Like, I don't have so much more information on that one, but I wonder why he recanted. Again, is it big noting? Maybe he just, I don't know, changed his mind about telling the truth.
Yeah, it's weird because even if he's like lying about some of them, like why this one all of a sudden, he's like, no, not that one.
Yeah. So in April, I feel like he really did escalate in 1997, 98, and 99. It seems to escalate quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In April of 1999, Deborah Harris and her daughter, Ambria Halliburton, who was 8, were killed in their home in Gibson, Tennessee. Tommy broke into their home and raped Deborah in her bed. She was stabbed with a kitchen knife, which he left in her chest. Tommy then stabbed the child 3 times because she was a witness. Mary Beatrice Perez, who was 9, was kidnapped from a festival in San Antonio in Texas of April 1999, so the same month. Tommy was convicted of her murder in 2003. So the only two murders he's ever been convicted of are Mary Beatrice and Katie Harris. So they're the only two murders he's ever been convicted of. It was established that Tommy kidnapped Mary Beatrice, drove her to a stockyard, raped her, and strangled her to death with her T-shirt, and he was sentenced to life for her murder. In Lexington, Kentucky, in May of 1999, Tommy raped and strangled Haley McCone, who was 13. He was confirmed to have been in that area as he was arrested for public intoxication and was released the next day. So, again, I just feel like this reminds me a little bit of Robert Napa in the Crystal, in the Rachel Nicole case. Just slipped through the cracks so many times. He was in prison so many times, and he just was able to keep getting out and keep this reign of terror going.
Yeah, and it just shows, like, how fortunate we are to have all these databases now, because I feel like if there was a better way to handle DNA and any other types of evidence that could compare to, especially across state lines, that a lot of these murders may not have happened because he probably, hopefully, would have been caught sooner.
In July of 1999, Bobby Lynn Wooford, who was 14, was picked up from a convenience store in Kingfisher, Oklahoma by Tommy. He drove her to a remote area, sexually assaulted her, and struck her multiple times in the head with a hatchet. He shot her in the head when she tried to escape. He dumped her body on the side of the road and kept her earrings as souvenirs. So the attack on Katie and the murder of Katie and the attack on Crystal happened in December of 1999, and that's when Tommy was finally arrested. So there are, like, I've gone through, there's a bunch of databases and online articles about his possible victims. They are the majority that I was able to kind of discern and separate because people refer to them differently. There may well have been more, but they are the ones that we're able to kind of definitively say have either been linked to him or he's confessed to. So Tommy's execution date was set for April 3rd of 2014. This information about that is from Crime Library. It says the average stay on Texas death row is 10 and a half years at a cost to taxpayers of $55 per day. No doubt that's gone up now, but that was the cost back then. It says when his time comes, cells will be given a dose of 3 drugs at a cost of $86, a deadly dose of the sedative sodium thiopental, a form of bromide muscle relaxant to collapse his lungs, and potassium chloride to stop his heartbeat. Katie Harris's adoptive father said he looks forward to that day. Terry says the family has saved a bottle of champagne they intended to use to toast the new millennium. It will be uncorked the minute that Tommy is executed. So while he was on death row, Tommy began to paint. I found this interesting. I found an article that said his work was, quote, kindergarten quality and included praying hands and a Texas flag with the message, Governor George Bush killed 135, still going strong. So there's a website called Supernaught, N-A-U-G-H-T.com. They have a bunch of Tommy's alleged artwork for sale, like hundreds and hundreds of dollars they're asking for this artwork. I've got a few screenshots. It is pretty basic. Like one
it's very like middle school girl.
Yeah, like something that you doodle in your diary or something. It's got like there's one with like a ram, I guess it's like a ram's or a sheep's head or something, and it says Kill Me State Texas, and it's like got blood droplets around it. There's another one with like eagles, I guess, against the moon. And there's one with some black roses, and it says Beautiful Wicked Witch. He spells wicked W-Y-K-E-D. Kath, peace and love. I don't know if Kath's someone who drew that for. I don't know, but very.
I was shocked at how nice the handwriting looks in that one, though.
Yeah, it looks like he might have even had one of those, you know, the old stencils that they used to.
Yeah, like Oh yeah, maybe that's why. I was like, it's pretty perfect.
I guess he's got all the time in the world to make it as neat as he wanted.
Very straight.
So as we mentioned, Tommy confessed many crimes to the authorities once he was arrested. He did stop cooperating at one point. And he said, I'm taking some time off from working so close with the Rangers. As a matter of fact, I've stopped for one or two reasons. Too much, too fast. They are getting on my nerves as I was getting on theirs. Them Rangers want to rip my guts out because I wanted a break. So on the day of his execution, Crystal Searles, who was a survivor of the attack and members of both the Harris and Perez families, traveled to the Texas State Penitentiary in Huntsville to watch Tommy's execution. He was asked if he would like to make a final statement, and he said no. At this point in time, prisons in Texas had stopped their last meal requests. So Tommy's final meal was just normal prison food. He had 3 pancakes, oatmeal, and applesauce. He was given the lethal dose of phenobarbital. He took his deep breaths, closed his eyes, and began to snore. He stopped moving after 1 minute, and he was pronounced dead 13 minutes later at 6:27 p.m. So there is some footage of the families outside the jail and they're in there. But one thing I did find kind of ironic was how peaceful his death was. He was literally given a shot, closed his eyes, went to sleep and died a few minutes later compared to the, you know, terror. I'm not saying an eye for an eye, but just it was interesting to me how much horror and terror and pain he inflicted on people, and his death was so peaceful in the end.
Yeah, I guess it would be frowned upon to kill people in a horrific way in prison. Yeah. But
I know in some countries they do like public stonings and, you know, all that, which I know is not a humane thing to do. I'm not advocating for that, but I just thought it was a very
juxtaposition.
He died in a very different way to those that he killed.
Yeah. I literally tormented people before killing them in a very horrible, slow, brutal way, especially after sexually assaulting women, which is... And he got a peaceful, seemingly peaceful death.
So I am interested in the motives that he had. Why did he kill all these people? He did seem to have a little bit of a pattern. He would often kill women with children. I guess, you know, he apparently never left many witnesses alive, which I guess is why he killed the children. Sergeant Terry Ward, who worked for the sheriff in Little Rock, Arkansas, told the media he wasn't some strange, far-out type person. He was just a normal person who loved to kill. If you made him mad, he'd kill. So I guess that goes with what Tommy said about how he killed one person because the person didn't pay for drugs. But then other cases, he would go and, like, kidnap children and murder them and things like that. So what did he have against those children? I feel like he was just a sadistic, horrible person filled with hate.
Yeah, and I feel like because he kept getting away with it, like he just kept being like, well, I'm just going to keep doing it because I just keep getting away with it, you know, and just keep doing worse and worse and worse things. And he just kept getting away with it. So like if he got such a thrill from it, there was really no reason for him to stop.
Yeah. And even his quote that we mentioned at the start where he said, I am hatred. When you look at me, you look at hate. I don't know what love is. Two words I don't use are love and sorry because I'm all about hate. I just feel like he really thought he was arrogant. He thought he could get away with it. And he literally just killed because he didn't want his crimes to be found out. And he, like you said, was able to keep getting away with it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I know I said I wasn't really interested in serial killers at the start. I guess I am, and probably why most people are interested in them is like, why do they get the thrill of it? Like, what excites them about killing people? And then kind of more so, how did they get there? Like with him, it seems like he had such like a horrible upbringing that it seems like he never knew love or empathy and was treated horribly as a child. So, I mean, if you're treated horribly your whole entire life and you never learn any different, that's probably how you're going to treat people going on and on. But
it's, yeah,
it's just like, how do you get to this point is what I wonder about with serial killers.
Just my observation. It seems to me that the murders of men that he carried out were probably like drug related, witness related, whereas more so the murders of the women he carried out were sexually motivated. Like when he went and tried to, when he killed Katie, he took off her pants and all that type of thing. Like, and he was spying on her and her mother and her sister and all that. I feel like he had different motivations for killing men and women. Men he just killed probably because they pissed him off.
They were there.
Didn't want to leave anyone behind. Too. Whereas I feel like the girls, seems like he sexually assaulted multiple victims. So I feel like it was probably sexually motivated for most of the female killings.
Yeah, and just crazy because the list is so long that honestly, like my brain kind of like shuts off halfway through because I don't know. That sounds bad because it's something that we're talking about, but you know what I mean? We're just like another one, another one, another one, another one, another one. And it's so horrible again and again and again that it's almost like my brain starts to be like, okay, this like can't be real in a way because it's like shocking and scary and horrific. And some of them were children.
Too. Yeah. Your brain just can't comprehend it, which is normal, I would think, for most people. Anyone who can comprehend it, maybe that's not normal.
That's what I think it is, because it's like logically I'm like, this is so horrible, but my brain's also like, that can't be real at the same time.
There is an author, true crime author named Diane Fanning. She has studied Tommy a lot. She wrote a book called Through the Window, and she claims that he killed with no apparent motive and no common pattern. So just literally an opportunistic killer, killing because he liked to kill, because he was angry at people, he hated people. It's scary just to think that, you know, I know like when we talk about, for instance, the Idaho and Moscow murders, I feel like they were targeted. He was pissed off at whoever in that house and that's why he carried out those murders. But for someone like this, who literally just sees someone on the street and takes the opportunity, it's terrifying.
Yeah. And what I was saying before, kind of, it was just like the list being so long. Half of them, most of them, they can't even prove. And it's like, it's not worth them to put in the effort proving.
Yeah.
But it's like, could there be so many more? Probably. Could there be less? Probably. How do we even know what's true and what's not, you know?
And also we spoke about how he was apparently struggled with addiction. He had mental health diagnoses. So, yeah, maybe he made some of these up. If he was in the throes of addiction, does he even remember all of the people that he killed? There could be more, there could be less. I agree.
I was thinking, does he remember their names, or like he would just describe something and then the police would go find the names? I'm like, there's no way he remembers.
That
like,
person went missing in Vegas at this time. Maybe it was this person. So
yeah,
I
like
know.
He's not remembering their names.
No. So yeah, a very crazy case, some horrific, horrible details for those families. I can't even imagine, like, you know, especially the ones that we mentioned where their bodies have never been found, and just knowing that what they would have gone through. I guess in the end he did die. He paid the ultimate price for his crimes, but just horrible.
Did he even
horrible.
Care? Probably
yeah,
not.
I don't think so. It doesn't sound like it. Do you want to make a statement? No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if he was somewhat relieved.
Yeah. I don't doubt it. He like, and there's all the photos of him. Like, there's some photos I've put on the blog. Like, he's always just, not always, but there's lots where he's like happy and laughing in prison clothes. And he spoke a lot in prison. There's a bunch of clips online and things like that. He's just smug and arrogant and vaulting.
He has like so many different looks too. Like, there's this one of him looking literally like Peter Griffin.
There's one, he reminded me a bit of James Gandolfini as well. In his later years, he was kind of like a bit chubbier and balding. And there's another one where he's like laughing with, it looks like, prison authorities because he's got black and white prison on, and his teeth look brown and yellow, and just, he's just horrible.
It's crazy to like look at this person and then think about that list and think that this person actually did all of those things. So that's it for this episode. Everything will be on the blog at truecrimesocietyblog.com, as always. Make sure you're following us on Instagram. Our account is True Crime Society, obviously. We're always posting updates there. We've been posting a lot more posts there, just all sorts of true crime news throughout the day we've been trying to keep up with. If you want to follow our personal accounts, mine is StephSum_Olivia's TCS Olivia. And if you enjoy the podcast, check out our Patreon because we do 2 episodes a week there. So this one and then a bonus episode, all ad-free. And there's also earlier release for the main episode. Plus, it's just kind of its own community there. And we have chats and things like that. So check us out on Patreon. If you could leave us some Spotify comments or share the podcast to your Instagram story, we'd love to reshare and see what everyone is doing while they're listening. And it's a big help to us to get the word out. So if you guys could do all those things, that'd be great. Love you guys so much. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe out there. Peace out.